The talk is going to be about Norwich textiles in the 18th century and pattern books and pattern cards and how they were used in the 18th century, but also looking at how I've been using them to interpret Norwich textile history. So we start off with a Norwich merchant, a merchant manufacturer, meaning that as a merchant he exported direct. Some manufacturers weren't merchants in that they traded through London. And the London dealers or merchants, they were acted as commission agents. Norwich manufacturers didn't necessarily take the orders direct. They came in through London. Norwich manufacturers then produced the goods and then sent them down to London to be exported. So this slide shows Jeremiah Ives the Younger. He was part of a business, Jeremiah and Jeremiah, Son and Baisley. And it gets very confusing because Jeremiah and Jeremiah, the son, was also Jeremiah, so sorting that one out was quite a problem. And so he would export through London, and rather than go by sea, most manufacturers sent their goods overland by a wagon, because this was more reliable. You knew on Tuesdays that the carriers were going down to London, and you knew that they would arrive on the Thursday. And the middle slide shows the Haymarket, and you can just see those curved shapes on the left-hand side. That's the coverings of the wagons that are being loaded from the Star. And that gibbet-like thing is a sign of the Star. And they would then go by road down to London to the merchant, and then the merchant would export them to Europe. The alternative route was by river, and exporting by river through Great Yarmouth didn't really take off until the 1760s, because during the war in this leading up to the 1760s, the merchants in London let Norwich manufacturers down, and the Norwich manufacturers said, right, we're going to export direct. So they would take their goods down to the river. And here we've got a picture of Harrison's Wharf. This is Harrison's Wharf here. And we know that Norwich manufacturers actually sent their goods through that particular wharf. They also took in Irish yarn coming in the other direction. They would go by wherry or smaller vessels down to London, down the river to Great Yarmouth. And then they would be exported to be sold by merchants and dealers in London to shopkeepers and so on. Now, just go right direction. Right. Can you hear me, by the way, at the back? Yeah, okay. There are a variety of pattern books, or what can be grouped as pattern books, and the first was costings books, and we'll come back to the costings book in a minute. Also production books, there's only one that I know of for Norwich. Marketing books and cards, which more generally would be called pattern books. Dispatch books and collector's books, and I'm going to talk about each of those in turn. So we go to the counting house, of a Norwich merchant. Whether it looked anything like this, I've no idea. But you can see sets of books on the shelves, ledgers, day books, and so on. But they would, Norwich manufacturers would also have a large collection of their pattern books that they'd have built up over a period of time. They would have used them not only for marketing, but also for future reference, for ideas, for designs. Now we start with the costings book, which is to do with production. And one of the big advantages of these books is that they take you step by step through the process of manufacturing. And you can see at the top, the first section is to do with the yarn that was used, then twisting, dyeing, filling, weaving, picking. It says singing there, but it's actually singeing. And we'll and 60% of making this particular fabric, which is a flowered satin, would be spent on yarn. So that's quite a considerable proportion of the production costs. This particular type of fabric was introduced in the late 16th century by Walloon weavers, and they continued making these fabrics into the 19th century. So we start at the top with the warp, which is the thread that was used for the length of the fabric, and the weft going across the fabric. In Norwich, the weft was also known as the shoot. And you can see the price there as 23 shillings out of 39 shillings, the total cost of production. This kind of fabric would be handmade. It would be made in weavers' homes, and the cost of the manufacturer would not include, it's not included here, the actual profit that was made, which was around about 10%. Now, where did the yarn come from? Where did the wool come from? The wool that was used in Norwich textiles in the 18th century did not come from Norfolk, or only in relatively small quantities. It came from the East Midlands, this area here. That's where some of the finest wool was grown, and it was long fibre, 8 to 12 inches long, and it was, when it was made into yarn, it went through a particular process that was quite different to the wool that was used to make blankets. And it's known as worsted yarn. It's not worsted wool, it's worsted yarn. And worsted is a generic term for a particular type of fabric that was made out of this yarn. The spinning would have been an East Anglian thing. So centred on Norwich, particularly centred on Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. These areas here, these places here, is where the wool was shipped out to Great Yarmouth and Ipswich. More yarn came from Southern Ireland. About a fifth of the yarn that was used in Norwich was Irish, but it was only used in the coarser fabrics, not in this fine and superfine fabrics. The superfine and fine fabrics used wool from this area here, from Leicester and Lincolnshire sheep. Now the process of manufacturing this wool into yarn was done by wool combers. And here we've got a picture of two wool combers, working next to their stove here. And you can see the length of the wool that they were using, that what they were trying to do is make it as straight as possible, and the 8 to 12 inch of fibres would be made into a strip of about 6 feet. And they would comb with wool combs. They would have two of these wool combs, and you can see that there is one attached to a post. There's the heating the combs. You had to have them hot, otherwise they wouldn't go through the wool. And this is the attachment to the post. It's called a pad. And you'd have a second comb, and you would comb through until you got your fibres parallel. Then you could spin them. And this is a picture of a wool comber at the second stage, and this is full of oil. And in the second stage, after the wool had been washed, it would be oiled, and then it would be combed all over again. I don't know if you can quite make it out. In the top corner, left-hand corner, you can see a bird cage. And it's almost, if it was in Norwich, it was almost certainly containing a canary. And these were introduced by the Dutch-speaking Flemish when they settled here in the 16th century. And that's how Norwich City has got is called the Canaries. Now, there are two methods of spinning. The very finest spinning was done by the spindle and distaff. This is this distaff, and she's got a length of this wool that's come from the wool comber, and she's using a spindle to spin the wool. This is from the 15th century Martham Church. And the reason I put that in is that the same technique was being used in the 18th century and in Norwich into the early 19th century, because when they started mechanising spinning wool, the machines could not compete with the really fine wools, fine yarns that were being produced in Norwich. Come back again. After spinning, the yarn had to be reeled, and you can see this woman reeling. This was to make a skein, and there was a particular technique of making a skein, the number of times you turned the reel was really important, and the standard was 560 yards long. It was really important that that length was kept, because the weavers worked out how many manufacturers worked out how many skeins they required for a particular job. And if you got the weavers partway through working and they find that the yarn is too short, they've got a problem, because it will have gone to the dyers. And the dyers would have to match to make up that deficiency in the yarn. So there are very strict rules about reeling. Now, if you use the wrong size reel, or you short reeled, you false reeled, you would be fined 5 shillings. Now, when you're only earning threepence a day, that's a week's work, 2 weeks work, 2.5 weeks work, that the woman would be fined. And so far I've been able to find over 2,000 women in Norfolk and a bit of Suffolk who were fined 5 shillings in the late 18th century. Now, if you repeated this false reeling or short reeling, you got a month in the bridewell with hard labour. Third time you would be in the marketplace whipped. So that's how strict they were about the reeling. Then the next step is twisting. Twisting is where you have two threads and they're twisted together. And they were used on the warp, the length of the fabric, to make sure that the warp was strong enough to take the weaver passing the shuttle through, because there are quite a lot of forces put on during weaving. Whereas the weft would be just a single thread. And that took 4% of the overall cost of production. Then there was the dyeing. Now, if you were looking at a production page like this, and you find that the dyeing is down towards the bottom, then you were looking at a completely different method of production. At the top here, it's dyeing before you weave, because you've got a pattern, so you've got to dye it beforehand. If it's down here, it's called dyeing in the piece. So it's after the weaver has finished, and it then only then does it go to the dyer. This is from, I should have said, from 1767. And here we've got a dyer's workshop. And this is St. Michael's Bridge, Castellane. And you've got what's called a dyer's boat. Now, I found an advert for a dyer's boat, and I didn't understand what it was. What it is, it's not people fishing, it's actually washing fabric. And this is the dye house. And you can see a little archway there. That's a doorway, so that the journeyman dyers can get to their boat. And the advantage of having a boat is that you could go to somewhere where the water is clean. We did, when I was in America doing some research, I worked with Jocelyn Alcantara Garcia on an analysis of the dye stuffs that were actually used in Norwich textiles. They had to get special permission for it, and these are some of the dye stuffs that were actually used in the manufacture of these particular fabrics that were produced in the 1790s in Norwich. And I've underlined just a couple of images for a couple of images of Lichen and Dyer's rocket. The Lichen, the Orca would help to produce purple, and the Dyer's rocket, yellow. And quercitron was a special dye that had been developed by a certain Edmund Bancroft, who worked with Michael Stark, who was a Norwich dyer. And Bancroft invented quercitron in the 1790s with help and advice from Michael Stark. And Norwich was one of the first, well, was the first major centre to use this particular dye stuff. And also, I've looked at adverts to try and expand on the dye theme. The idea of exporting Norwich textiles, you have to look at it in the other direction as well, of dye stuffs coming in from all over the world. And I've underlined some of the dye stuffs that were imported and the places where they would have come from in Britain, in Europe, in the world, sorry. The next stage would be warping. This that takes up 1%. And this is an actual warping machine that was used in St. Augustine's in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And the warping machine was used to prepare the warp to go on the loom. And you can see an actual warp here that was used to make Calimanco in 2018. And the idea behind the warping machine is that you had the yarn on spindles, and they were gathered at this place called a heck block, and then the mill reel was spun round, and it was done at, so that there was no overlapping, because you had to keep the threads in the right order. Imagine keeping, trying to keep all those threads in the right order, so when they went to the weaver, they could be put straight onto the loom. And this is how it worked. As it spun around that way, you can see there's a little pulley system. When it spins in one direction, it goes down, and when it's spun in the other direction, it goes up. And when it goes up, it doesn't overlay. And then we have weaving, and this particular fabric was woven on a draw loom, which was more complicated than a hand loom. And the back part of the loom, which you've got a picture here, you can see it's quite different to the foot loom that we were looking at earlier on. If you divided this loom up, that part would be like a foot loom that I showed you in the picture earlier on. And the back part was much more complicated, because that would create the figure, the design. And that had a particular method of making. This is a Chinese loom, and I've shown this picture because it shows clearly the foot loom and the draw loom part of it. So that part makes the background, the plain background, that part makes the flowers. This is before the jacquard loom. And you would have a set of pulleys at the top, and the thread, the simples, the cords would come back, and you would have these simple cords and a boy pulling on, a draw boy pulling on these cords to raise the warp threads in a particular order so that the pattern can be created. And there's the top of the draw loom with all the pulleys. This is what it would look like between here and there. So you can see somebody had to set this up in the correct order so that every thread, you might have 2,000 warp threads or 1,000 warp threads, each warp thread had to be joined in exactly the right place to give the right grouping for the boy to pull at a particular time on the instructions of the weaver, and then they pull on another one and another one until the pattern is being developed. And that's underneath the draw loom. These are weights, because if you pull up, it's got to come back down again.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Would you prefer?
No.
The cylindrical warp, where they did
yes.
the overlap, how did that transfer? Did it stand beside them when they transferred it?
No, they took when they've done the warping, they took the warp off and tied it into a kind of a knot, and they then took it in a bundle to the weaver, to the mounter, the person who mounted the draw loom. And that would be put on a back beam on the draw loom, and each thread would be threaded through the lube, and also the correct necking cords on the loom. So it's quite a complicated process, and it is a highly skillful process. Weaving something like the flowered satins was relatively easy. The difficult part was actually setting up the loom to do it. And it could take quite a long time. If I go back there, you can see how pulling on the red cord lifts these particular chords. So you can see how these chords could be lifted individually to lift the warp threads. Now the next part was picking. So when it came off the loom, women particularly would be repairing any faults in the fabric. They would be cutting off knots and just tidying it up to make it look perfect. I'll miss that out because that's to do with draw loom. And then there was singeing and dressing. Now singeing, I can't show you the machine, but can you see these fibres on this? Can you see these white fibres? They would be burned off, the fabric. They had a big frame and with rollers on it, and the fabric would be taken over these rollers to a crank. You'd have two men here holding the fabric on the back of the ladder, the frame, and over here you would have a crank. The fabric would come over the frame and then go to the crank, and there would be two men cranking the fabric as fast as they can, because very close to the frame is a curved metal plate which is red hot, and so they have to take the fabric over that surface as fast as they can to burn off the fibres, and then they turn it over and do it all over again. Then they have to let it cool off. The next task in finishing is calendaring. And calendaring is the process, I've got to watch the time, the process of pressing, you know, when you iron, you're pressing the fabric to make it smooth. Well, here you've got a calendaring machine, and this thing would weigh between 10 and 20 tons. And your fabric would be put in underneath that there on these rollers. And you can see that there's a worker here actually rolling the fabric onto the roller. And this is an English silk calendaring machine, so it's lighter than the one we just looked at. So it depended on the type of fabric and the look that you wanted. What it did was help to compress the fibres, but also gave a nice sheen to the fabric. There's a man. And just to show you how it worked, it would just be pulled backwards and forwards. Now this one would have been worked by a man who was pushing around on this, going round one way, then the other way. In Norwich, I know that they used a horse and a boy. So the horse would go in one direction, the boy would turn it round, bring it back again. And they also used a wheel, which was the smoothest way of doing it. You had men inside the wheel driving the machine. And the effect of this, that's a piece of calendar that hasn't been calendared. And that has, and you can see how the fibres have been squashed flat. And the other thing that they did was to press using a hot press, and they also put on a beautiful glaze on the fabric so that it made the fabric shine. And they did this by folding the fabric and then having sheets of paper which were glazed either side, and you had a wooden board top and bottom, you had hot iron plates either side of the wooden board. The wooden boards were there because it was to protect the fabric, and the heat was transferred from the hot plates to the glazed paper. But not only did they do that, You can see this, this is an actual piece of hot press paper. It's the only one that I know of anywhere in the world. This is in Paris. And you can see the glaze on the surface, the shine. That glaze, that shininess, would be transferred to the fabric. And there's the press, there's the wooden boards, there's the fabrics, but also you had a furnace underneath. So you were actually heating the fabrics from underneath, and then you had the pressure of the press from above. Very dangerous work.
What was the glaze made of?
I think I might mention that. Beeswax was one. Sandarac gum. And what was the other one? Tragacanth gum. So it was recently analysed in Amsterdam. And there you can see the shininess on the piece of Calimanco and Tabaret. So really, really shiny. And also, you can also see the fold marks. There's a fold there. There's a fold mark on somebody's dress. Right, next type of pattern book is for marketing. And they were posted to customers down to London, to Great Yarmouth, and then sent by sea. Or they, Norwich had foreign riders, which were commercial travellers. And they would, I know that one Norwich manufacturer sent a foreign traveller to Spain, another one sent one to Italy, and their job was to collect orders and then send them back to Norwich. And they needed books and patterns to do this. And the pattern books were made in Norwich. I know that some were produced by a stationer in London Street. And the books needed to open flat. The swatches themselves should be the same size. And that they should be glued in exactly the same position right the way through the book. So when it was closed, it looked, it was closed evenly. And the last thing that was mentioned, that the recommendation for this type of book was that they should be not only functional, that is being able to market, but they should be pleasing. It's important for the customer to enjoy looking at the book, because that helped to persuade them to buy. And the book, this one has got certain information. It's got the name of the fabric, which is checked Camlatee. That's the one that we were looking at with the squared, the flattened fabric. It gives the dimension, 16 inches, 28 yards. And these numbers, the pattern numbers, so when a customer received the pattern book, he would need to know, or she would need to know, which pattern they were ordering. So they would say 10 of pattern 551.
You have two patterns, that 4548 at the top looks to be the same as 552, although 552 has got a slight sort of diagonal.
Yeah. They could be the same as. I've not spotted that one, but people do. Manufacturers did make mistakes, and they put the wrong swatch in the wrong place. So somebody has actually well spotted, put two patterns in the same, on the same page. And accompanying the pattern book would be price list. And this is really useful because it gives an idea of the prices of the fabrics that these particular manufacturers were selling. There's the Czech Camlatee. That's 22 shillings for a piece, 16 inches by 28 yards. If you were buying a lasting, everlastings would be used on things like shoes because it's hard wearing and very fine you'd pay £4 five shillings, which was a lot more. Slightly different size though. This is a pattern book in the V&A, and it was a copy of this was taken to Spain by a traveller, and he left Norwich in early 1763, went to Exeter, and I've got an idea that he was met somebody down in Exeter so that they could sell some of their goods. So they were selling not only Norwich goods, but Exeter goods in Spain. But one of the things that I noticed on this, it says card number 4. So this pattern book is actually a set of cards that have been put together in a book. And these would have been kept by the manufacturer. The manufacturer always kept a copy for themselves. Because if somebody in Spain was making an order for 551, single camlets, you would want to know exactly what 551 looked like. And then you can start preparing, doing your costings book, getting your costings sorted out, your yarn sorted out, and distributed to the weavers who are working at home. And this is what pattern card looked like. In Norwich there is, in the museum collection, there's a set of 5, and they were kept safely. The idea was that when you went to a customer, you open these out in front of them. That's why they had to look good. But handling was a problem, because too much handling took the glaze off and reduced its effectiveness a little bit. So you've got in the Norwich Counting House these counterpart pattern books or pattern cards, which would go through the process of being sent to London or through Great Yarmouth. And the merchant or customer overseas would have an identical set. And these pattern books would be kept, as I said earlier on, in the manufacturer's archive. When that manufacturer went out of business, another manufacturer would buy up that archive, because it added to their collection of designs. So they had a bigger range of designs to go through. And this is actually from a sales book from a firm called Stannard Taylor and Taxter, and they were in the telephone house, where telephone house in St Giles. Their manufacturing, their house was pulled down to build that telephone house. And so this would have been produced in their accounting house. You can see at the top 40 pieces of flower satins, 24 pieces of florettes, and 30 pieces of common debarettes. And by referring to pattern books, you can see the kind of fabrics, the different designs that would have been sent out. So you've got the flowered satin at the top, the florettes there, and the tabaret there, all made in completely different ways. And these samples give you the opportunity of working out exactly how these fabrics were made. The other thing was that this fabric called swanskins, they were probably not produced in Norwich. Norwich manufacturers used to buy in fabrics on a small scale, and swanskins were a very fine cloth, and quite often they were used as a wrapper for the Norwich products. And then you've got this mark at the side, that's a merchant mark, also known as a ship mark or a bale mark. And you've got a pat number. So you know that Christopher Schutz of Berlin, you know that that was his 7th order. So you can see immediately if it's pack number 1, there's a new customer. And there. They're the marks on packs, and it's a bit like a barcode. It followed through the whole process of shipping. So from the manufacturer, he would put the merchant mark onto the pack of fabric. It would also go on customs documentation, and it would go and at the other end, it was important for the manufacturer, the buyer, to be able to identify their pack so that they could take it away from the quayside. Another document, this is a shipping agent's book, and this is a number of Norwich manufacturers. Norwich manufacturers tended to not send their products on their own. What they did was to come together as a group, and they would hire a ship. And that was the safest way of sending goods. And this is a picture actually of the John and Mary that I know that carried packs from Great Yarmouth to the Netherlands, to Rotterdam. And there's the names of the manufacturers and how many packs they sent, 77 in all. I know this was 1796, but I've used the average of a pack in 1802. That's the value of that cargo was £6,000, which is nearly £300,000 today. And this is quite, you're probably looking at £10,000 worth of goods, £15,000 of goods, which would probably the equivalent in one ship of today's prices between £1 and £1.5 million. So, you know, we're really looking at very, very, very valuable cargoes. John Tuttle and Christopher Hamp, I'll show you a couple of pictures of their work. We've mentioned the influence of the Walloons. Well, this is the 1790s. This character called Flint, he was German. Daniel Froman Teal, he was of Dutch descent. William and Robert Herring, Dutch descent. John Christopher Hamp, German. Do you know the Waffle House in St. Giles? I think that's where he was based. Edward Marsh and son Edward, went to Russia to become a merchant. Peter Columbine, French Huguenot. And that's the 1790s. French Huguenot origin. And this is just an example of John Christopher Hamp's work. He came to Norwich in the 1780s and established himself in business in St. Giles. And this is John Tuttle, who was based in Guildengate. So again, these patterns, these swatches help in being able to identify. For example, at the moment, I'm working with a volunteer in the Zands Museum in the Netherlands. She's sending me photographs of skirts and so on made out of Norwich textiles, and I'm going through and looking at the swatches and saying, yes, this is a spotted camelotee or whatever. This is where Great Yarmouth ships went, all over Europe. I've been able to identify over 2,000 ships that carried Norwich packs. And Stannard, Taylor and Taxter in St. Giles, this is where they sent all their goods between 1764 and 1769. So the map before only gives you an idea of where the goods were sent. Once you start looking at the Stannard and Taylor pattern, you can start seeing the importance of rivers like the Rhine. And then the next type of book is the production book. And this is just a page from the book, and I'm just going to look at this section here. this CP, that tells you the code for the customer, and it tells you the date when it was ordered, which is the 8th of August 1795. So looking at that detail, it gives you the information about the type of fabric, the dimension, 17 inches by 28 yards. It gives you technical details. I mentioned the reed earlier on. That tells you which reed was used, tells you how much warp was used, the fineness of the yarn, the number of warp threads that were used, and how much the warp cost. Now, I've been able to put together, analysing this, over 10,000 records. And using those records, you can actually build up a picture of the different quantities of fabrics that were made and so on. This tells you when it was dyed. 31st of August tells you the name of the dyer, somebody called Hodds. This tells you the name of the hot presser. And most interesting, really, for me, is the names of the weavers. So you're actually able to attach a swatch to a particular weaver. And this tells you the names of the weavers and how many pieces that were made for that particular order. And what I've taken is just this person here, Pleasance Fiddy. She lived in Horsham St. Faiths, and I've just been put together the kind of fabrics that she was making. When the order came in, it tells you the warp threads, so that tells you that she was working at the coarser end of the fabrics, the cheaper end of the fabrics, not the super fine end. Or the and this one at the bottom gives William Fiddy and Pleasance Fiddy, and she's actually working with her father on this particular fabric. Can I just go back? No, it's not there. Right. Now these are this is a dispatch book from Jeremiah Ives, Son and Baisley, and there are four of these, and they're an amazing record. The pages that I got really interested in were the ones like this. These are Calimanco's. I'll come back to that in a minute. I'll tell you when. This again gives you the total number of pieces. That's the date of dispatch. That gives you the number of pieces that of that particular type of fabric, gives you the reed size, the name of the fabric, the dimensions, and it gives you the merchant's mark and the pack number. That is 245, so that's their 245th order. So quite substantial customer. Now when I started to analyse this, I looked at 1791 exports, and there were 43,755 pieces exported in that year. 12,975 were dispatched in May, which is very odd, and 10,743 pieces dispatched on 2nd of May. And that caused me quite a bit of a problem to try and work out exactly what was happening. So on the 2nd of May, 6,095 pieces were Calimanco's and 3,600 Camlets. Now, I knew that Calimanco's were very popular in Russia, and this, I suspected, was St. Petersburg. So after a little bit of research, or quite a lot of research, I discovered that the Gulf of Finland froze over until April, around about April, May time. So that's why you've got this peak, because what's happening is the manufacturers in Norwich are scrambling. There's four ships waiting off of Great Yarmouth to put all this fabric into the ships to take to St. Petersburg. And the Kalimanka was particularly favoured by Crimean Tartars to wear as sashes. Now in 1793, Catherine the Great banned certain woolen fabrics. Amongst them were Kalimankos. This is 1791, that's 1798. Nothing. That's the impact. But there was a second reason, was the French Revolutionary War. And that's the impact that it had on Norwich businesses. Now finally, I've got 5 minutes, this page from Ives's dispatch book consists mostly of double camlets, which were 30 inches long and 55 yards long and 30 inches wide. That tells me that that was to do with the China trade. Now the East India Company were exporting Norwich camlets, which were very, very fine plain weave fabric, very closely woven. And what we've got here are not exports of the East India Company, they're the exports of officers of the East India Company. And I don't know who they are, except for one. Officers of East India Company, depending on your rank, are allowed a certain hold space to take goods to China. Yes.
Sorry, we're doing another talk in the auditorium in 2.
I'm nearly there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And what these officers were doing were competing against their own company. So they were actually smuggling. This is actually contraband. So, and I came across the top section there, and it says 32 pieces, single camlets, 55 by 30, in boxes, directed to Horatio Beaver, to be left at the Bull in Bishopgate Street, and sent 16th of October 1798. And did find a picture of him as Horatio Beaver, and he eloped with Mary Leeds of Reedham, age 15, to Coldstream, and he married in August. He was forced to he had to remarry when he came back to Norwich and St. Saviour's, and he goes to London on the 11th. His wife follows him on the 17th, and he's promoted to first mate of the EIC company ship Carnatic, and that's a picture of the Carnatic. And the Bull still exists, and we know that the Carnatic sailed on 1st of January and moored in Canton in China in June, so quite a long voyage. And then finally, we've got these camlets that were part of the legal trade, and the East India Company they sent out their instructions and they had to be followed precisely. They even sent out their own patterns with these colours, and those colours had to be exact, otherwise they would get rejected. And they had to put two roses at the end of each length of fabric. They would go through inspection. if they did fail their inspection, one of the roses was cut off so that they couldn't put it through again. And the last thing is this Anders Burk. He was the first professor of political economy in Europe. He was at Uppsala University, and he was the first academic to use visual aids in his teaching. And he made a big collection which still exists. Part of that collection was this pattern book, which was collected by a firm called Lindgren in London. They were Swedish, and they sent this to add to his collection. There's an example. I've got a feeling that might be sailcloth covering the fabric. And just to just to give you an idea of the fabrics that the costume that still exists in museums in different parts of Europe and the United States. Winterthur is in Delaware. And lastly, interest in Norwich textiles in Europe is quite alive. This is a Dutch skirt made out of Norwich textile, looks like that. This is a Dutch hemdrock. What's the name of the museum?
Zeeland
Museum in Zeeland. They've got a collection of hemdrocks that look like this. And they had an exhibition early in the year of Norwich textiles. And this is Norwegian, and this is woven in the 21st century, and that's a Norwich flowered satin from the 18th century, quite similar. So there's a real interest in Norwich textiles.